Welcome to the deep dive. Ever wonder how scientists figure out if a new drug might work? Like how it actually latches onto a protein?
Or, you know, how enzymes in our bodies speed up reactions. It's fascinating stuff.
Totally. And molecular simulation is, well, it's a really key tool for understanding all that, basically creating tiny virtual experiments.
Exactly right. Methods like molecular dynamics, MD, or Monte Carlo, MC, they let us watch molecules interact at that tiny scale.
But there's a catch, right? Simulating these especially big biological systems, it takes massive amounts of computer time.
Oh, definitely. Huge amounts. And many of the really interesting things happening in biology, they happen over, well, long time scales.
Yeah, like a protein folding up into its working shape, that can take ages in real time.
And that's way beyond what we can typically capture with these standard all-atom simulations. It's a serious bottleneck.
Capturing those long events, atom by atom, it just becomes, yeah, computationally impossible really quickly.
It really does.
So, how do scientists get around this? How do you bridge that timescale gap?
Well, that's where this idea of coarse graining comes in. CG for short.
Coarse graining, like zooming out, using a simpler map for a long trip.
That's a great analogy, yeah. Instead of tracking every single atom, you group them into like larger beads or units.
Okay, so fewer moving parts to worry about.
Precisely. It lets you simulate much bigger systems for much longer times while hopefully still capturing the important physics.
And there are different ways to build these CG models.
Yeah, mainly two flavors. Top down, which uses experimental data to kind of guide the model,
Okay.
and bottom up, which tries to derive the coarse-grained interactions from a detailed all-atom picture.
Right. And today we're diving into those bottom-up methods, but the traditional way of doing that, it has its own issues, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Usually you need these really long, detailed all-atom simulations just to train the coarse-grained model to figure out how the beads should interact.
Okay. And that leads to a bit of a like a chicken and egg situation.
Exactly. It's a perfect way to put it. The CG model you build is only as good as the all-atom data you fed it.
So it can only really reproduce what you already saw in that super detailed simulation.
Pretty much. It might totally miss new shapes, new configurations, new states that just didn't happen to show up in your initial expensive simulation.
Right, like trying to understand a whole ecosystem just by watching the squirrels. You miss the bears.
You got it. So you're limited by what you already knew or what you could afford to simulate in full detail.
And it's not just missing things. There's another problem with these traditional methods, something called back mapping.
Ah, yes, back mapping. That's a big one. So you run your fast CG simulation great, but then how do you get back the full atom by atom picture?
Which you might need, right? For certain
Well,
details.
definitely. But because you simplified things, going back isn't straightforward. It's often kind of fuzzy, ambiguous. There's no single perfect answer.
Okay, so limitations in capturing new stuff and problems getting the detail back. That sets the stage.
It does.
But today, we're looking at something new, a potentially different approach, a data-free method for coarse graining.
Yes, this is the really exciting part. The framework aims to approximate the fundamental Boltzmann distribution.
The Boltzmann distribution.
Yeah.
That's like the probability of finding the molecule in different arrangements at a certain temperature.
Exactly. It describes the equilibrium statistics. And this method aims to get at that directly from the rules of how atoms interact, the interatomic potential.
Without needing those long simulations first.
Without needing any pre-collected simulation data. That's the key. Just using the energy function itself.
Wow. Okay, so the potential here is, well, it's about overcoming those limits of the data-driven way as well.
Precisely. By focusing directly on the energy landscape, the hope is you can uncover the molecule's inherent tendencies, maybe even find completely new states, rather than just copying what you've seen before.
Discovering new molecular behaviors without years of simulations, that sounds pretty revolutionary.
It could be.
Okay, so our mission for this deep dive is to unpack this data-free idea for you, the listener. We want to get into the core concepts, how it works, the upsides, all without making your head spin.
It sounds good. Let's dig in.
Right. So this core idea, energy-based coarse graining, how does it work fundamentally?
Well, the central idea, as we said, is approximating that Boltzmann distribution.
Right.
But it does this using only the energy, that interatomic potential and its derivatives, which are basically the forces between the atoms.
So not looking at trajectories over time, but directly at the energy rules.
Exactly. It's a fundamental shift from needing those long MD runs for training data.
Now, the paper mentions Boltzmann generators, BGs. Are they related?
They are related, yeah. BGs also use the system's energy for training. They often use these fancy math tools called normalizing flows to learn the Boltzmann distribution. Very powerful.
Oh, I love it.
BGs typically operate on the full all-atom system. They don't inherently do the coarse graining, the simplification into fewer variables that's central to this new method.
Got it. BGs make all-atom faster. This method creates a simpler representation from the energy. Okay. Now, the simplest way to do this energy training involves minimizing the reverse Kullback-Leibler divergence, KL divergence.
Right, KL divergence. It's basically a mathematical way to measure how different two probability distributions are. Are they similar? Are they far apart?
Okay. And minimizing the reverse KL tries to make the model distribution match the true one.
Yes. Specifically, the reverse KL encourages the model to cover all the modes or peaks of the target distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be computationally tricky, especially with lots of atoms, high dimensions.
And it has this tendency, mode seeking. What does that mean?
Mode seeking means it might find one or maybe a few of the most probable states, the piece in the distribution, but it might completely miss other less probable but still important states.
Like our ice cream analogy earlier, just finding vanilla because it's common, missing the pistachio.
Exactly like that. Or finding the restaurant with the shortest queue, not necessarily the best food.
Okay. And there are ways to try and fix this. The paper mentions alpha divergence and annealed importance sampling, AIS.
Yeah, those are techniques aimed at getting better coverage. Alpha divergence has slightly different mathematical properties, and AIS is a method that can help discover those hidden modes by sampling from sort of modified versions of the distribution.
But AIS can be expensive too.
It often is, yeah. It involves its own set of potentially costly simulations.
And what about other machine learning approaches? Things like PIS, DDS, DES neural samplers.
Those are also really powerful ML tools. They can learn to approximate Boltzmann distributions directly from the energy without needing MD data beforehand. Very cool stuff.
But again, they usually work at the full atom level.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
Like BGs, they don't inherently build in that simplification, that coarse graining step, which is what makes this new framework distinct.
Okay, that's a great setup. So now let's get into this proposed flow-based framework. What's the core innovation?
The really central idea is how they reparameterize or sort of redescribe the full atom configuration. Let's call the atom positions X. They use a special transformation.
Special how?
It's bijective, meaning it's perfectly reversible, one-to-one mapping. And it's learnable, so its details are figured out during training. This transformation, let's call it Fi, splits X into two sets of variables.
Okay, splitting the atom coordinates into what?
Into the coarse-grained variables, which they call Z, and a complementary set of variables called X.
So Z is the simplified picture, and X holds the remaining details needed to get back to the full picture X.
Essentially, yes. Think of Z's as capturing the main structural features, the slow changes, and X as capturing the faster local fluctuations around that main structure.
And there's a statistical reason for this specific kind of split.
Yes, and it's quite clever. The goal is to encourage the probability distribution of Z, the coarse variables, to be multimodal.
Multimodal, multiple peaks, representing different stable shapes or states.
Exactly, like different conformations of a protein. At the same time, they want the distribution of X, given a specific Z, to be unimodal.
Unimodal, just yeah. One peak. So for a given core shape Z, the remaining details X just fluctuate around a single average configuration.
That's the idea. Local, jiggling around a stable state.
And how do they model the combined probability of Z and X?
They model the joint density as a product, a flexible part for Z that can capture those multiple modes. They use a normalizing flow for this.
Normalizing flow again. These powerful tools for complex distributions.
Right. And then a simpler unimodal part for X given Z could just be a Gaussian, for instance.
And importantly, these properties, multimodal Z, unimodal X given Z, they aren't forced onto the transformation.
No, that's key. They emerge from the training objective, from trying to match the overall Boltzmann distribution in this transform space.
Okay, so the training objective, what is it exactly?
They aim to minimize the KL divergence again, but this time between their approximating distribution, the QXZ model, and the true Boltzmann distribution transformed into these XZ coordinates.
Making their model match the reality, but in this new simplified coordinate system.
Precisely.
And you said this training achieves two things simultaneously.
Yes. That's really neat. First, it learns the optimal transformation, F phi itself. It figures out the best way to split the coordinates into Z and X to capture the system's statistics.
So it learns the coarse graining map.
Right. And second, it fits the parameters of their probabilistic model, QXZ, the one with the normalizing flow for Z and the simple conditional for X. So it's learning the simplification and the model of the simplified system all at once.
Learning how to simplify and the result of simplifying.
Hmm.
Clever. You mentioned a dynamical interpretation earlier, even though it doesn't use dynamics data.
Yeah, it's just intuition, really. You can think of Z as representing the slow degrees of freedom, the things that change slowly, governing transitions between states. X, conditioned on Z, represents the fast degrees of freedom. The local widders that quickly equilibrate around whatever slow state Z is in. The method finds this statistical separation without needing time data, but it aligns with that physical picture.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's recap the big advantages of this approach. What are the key takeaways?
Well, first, thermodynamic consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's approximating the full Boltzmann distribution, just in new coordinates, the model should, in principle, reproduce the correct average values for any physical property you could measure, both at the coarse and fine levels.
That's huge. Reliable predictions, even from the simplified model. What else?
Second, interpretability and flexibility. That bijective map lets you incorporate physical insight. If you know certain atom groups are important, you can sort of guide the transformation.
Making the model potentially easier to understand and generalize.
Right. And third, it directly tackles that backmapping problem we discussed. Because the map FI is learned, specific, and perfectly reversible, you can go from your XZ sample straight back to the full atom coordinates X. No ambiguity, no separate fuzzy step needed.
Wow. That solves a major headache with traditional CG.
It really does, and maybe the most crucial advantage.
No pre-collected MD data needed.
Exactly. Training only requires evaluating the all-atom energy and forces. It completely bypasses the need for those long, expensive, potentially biased initial simulations, directly addressing the chicken and egg problem.
Okay, this sounds really powerful. Let's get a bit more into the weeds of methodology details. There's this assumption about multimodality being concentrated in a lower dimensional space.
Yes, it's a common assumption in CG. The idea is that the really important slow changes defining different states often depend on just a few collective variables, like key angles or distances.
Like the Phipps-Xi angles in a protein backbone.
Precisely. The rest of the atomic motions are faster fluctuations around those key coordinates. This method tries to find and isolate those important slow variables in Z.
And mathematically, they start with the Boltzmann PX, use the map X equals SAXC to get PVXZ.
Right, which includes a term from the transformation itself, the Jacobian. Then they introduce their approximation, Q theta XZ, which is that product Q theta Z times Q theta X Z depth.
The flow for Z, the simple conditional for X.
And the goal is to make Q theta X Z match PVXZ by minimizing that KL divergence. That optimizes both the map phi and the model theta.
They discuss using a specific linear map X equals A phi times ZX.
Yeah, a linear map is a simpler starting point. The matrix A psi defines how Z and X combine to give X. They mention a condition on the rows summing to 1, which ensures it handles rigid translations and rotations correctly.
And traditional CG methods are sort of like specific choices of this matrix.
You could view them that way, yes.
Yeah.
But here, the aim is to learn the best linear map. And crucially, by keeping track of X, they retain the info for perfect backmapping.
They also use a special case where A phi is just a permutation matrix. What does that mean?
A permutation matrix just shuffles coordinates. So in this context, it means they predefine which original atom coordinates become Z and which become X. Just a fixed partitioning.
Like for alanine dipeptide, maybe backbone atoms are Z, side chain atoms are X?
Exactly. That's the example they use. This assumes you have some prior knowledge about which atoms govern the slow multimodal behavior. The backbone atoms are a good guess for that molecule.
How does this compare to the relative entropy RE method used in other CG work?
The key difference is data dependence. The RE method typically minimizes a forward KL divergence, which requires you to have samples from the target all-atom distribution PX, so you need that long MD run first.
Back to the chicken and egg.
Right, and RE gives you a CG model, but doesn't inherently solve the backmapping. This new reverse KL approach builds the model from the energy rules without needing samples from PX, and the learned map includes the back mapping.
Okay, let's talk training. How do they actually get the model to learn? Algorithm 1 in the paper.
Right, so they need to calculate the gradient of that KL loss function to update the model parameters, theta and phi. Since working with the true PPhi is hard, they use Monte Carlo estimation.
Meaning they use sampling.
Yes. they sample Zs from their current model using the normalizing flow. Then for each sample Z, they need to estimate expectations involving the conditional distribution P phi X.
How do they do that? More simulations?
Yes, but targeted ones. They run relatively short MD or MCMC simulations for X while keeping Z fixed. Because they assume P phi is simpler, unimodal, these simulations should equilibrate much faster than simulating the full system.
Ah, so they still use MDM-CMC, but in a much more focused and efficient way during training.
Exactly. It's part of the gradient estimation, not for generating bulk training data beforehand. And it helps discover the shape of Q thetas in that lower dimensional space.
And they use standard optimization tools, SGD, ADAM.
Yep, stochastic gradient descent, usually with the ADAM optimizer, to adjust the model parameters based on those estimated gradients. Sure. Standard machine learning practice.
Now that tempering scheme seems critical. Can you walk through that again? How does it avoid the mode-seeking trap?
Okay, tempering. The core idea is start easy, then get harder. They begin training at a very high effective temperature, or low inverse temperature.
Which makes the energy landscape look flat. Smoothed out.
Pretty much. Very few distinct peaks and valleys. The distribution is broad, almost uniform. The model can explore easily.
And then?
Then they gradually decrease the temperature, increase the mirror, towards the real target temperature. The model trained at one temperature serves as the starting point for the next, slightly lower temperature.
Like slowly bringing a blurry image into focus.
That's a perfect way to think about it. It lets the model gradually see and adapt to the important states, the MOVEs, as they emerge, without getting locked on to just one early on. Hmm. It helps ensure it finds, ideally, all the relevant configurations.
Okay, so you've trained the model using tempering. How do you then use it to, say, generate a typical molecular structure?
It's a generative model, so you can sample from it. First, you sample a random vector, say epsilon, from a simple base distribution, like a Gaussian.
The input to the flow.
Right. Then you push epsilon through the trained normalizing flow, G theta, to get a coarse-grained sample Z.
So you have the coarse structure, now the details.
Now you need X. You can either sample X directly from your learned proximate conditional K theta XE, or, for higher accuracy, run a short MDM-CMC simulation for X conditioned on your sample Z using the true conditional potential U phi Z.
Okay, now you have Z and X.
Finally, you use the inverse of that learned bijective map, a phi inverse, to transform Z and X back into the full atomistic coordinates X. And voila, you have a configuration sampled from the model's approximation of the Boltzmann distribution.
And you can calculate things like free energy or average properties.
Yes. The normalizing flow for V gives you the probability density Q theta, which is directly related to the free energy in the coarse grain space.
Useful for understanding stability.
Definitely. And for average properties of the full system, like the average radius of gyration, you can use important sampling. Generate samples X using the process above, calculate the property for each sample, and then weight the results to correct for any small differences between your model Q theta and the true target P phi.
Okay, let's touch on the model specifics. Normalizing flows for Q theta, why are they good here?
Their strength is expressivity. They can learn really complex multimodal probability distributions, which is exactly what you expect for the coarse grain variable Z that capture distinct molecular states.
And they used coupling layers with monotonic rational quadratic splines. Sounds fancy.
It does. They're just specific, powerful building blocks for the flow. Coupling layers are a standard way to build invertible transformations. Rational quadratic splines are very flexible functions that map one value to another in a smooth, reversible way.
And they're differentiable and invertible, which you need for flows.
Exactly. They've worked well in Boltzmann generators, too. But the authors stress that because their framework isolates the complexity into the lower dimensional Z space, the flow itself can be relatively simple, fewer parameters than flows trying to model everything.
They also mentioned changing the base distribution, epsilon, to a truncated normal. Why?
Those spline functions work best over a specific input range. Using a truncated normal just ensures the initial sample's epsilon stay within that valid range, especially early in training when things might be unstable. Avoids numerical problems.
And they used standard tools like FlowJax, Equinox, JAX.
Yep, common Python libraries for this kind of work. Good for building flows and using automatic differentiation for training.
Okay, let's get to the results. How did it actually perform? First, the 2D double well potential.
Classic test case. Two stable states, by one is the slow coordinate. They set Z-band 1, X by 2.
Did it work?
Without tempering, they saw the mode-seeking issue. It often got stuck in just one well. But with tempering, gradually increasing beta.
It found both.
It found both. Figure 1 shows the potential and distribution evolving during tempering, and figure 2 shows the final samples matching the true distribution really well. Tempering was crucial.
So the tempering really does the job. What about the Gaussian mixture model, GMM? More complex.
Yeah, they used a GMM with 3 modes in Z space. Tested it in low dimensions. Z was 2D, X was 4D. In higher dimensions, Z was 10D, X was 20D.
Then how did 2?
In the low D case, figure 3 shows it captured all 3 modes beautifully. The samples matched the target contours really well.
Okay, high D.
High D is where CG really shines, reducing complexity. But it's also where mode seeking bites harder. Figure 4 shows that without tempering, reverse KL missed modes badly.
But with tempering?
With tempering, figure 5 shows it nailed it. The 1D marginal distributions across all 10 Z's dimensions matched the target very well. It found all the modes. Really shows the power of combining the CG idea with careful training.
Very promising on the toy models. Now the real test, alanine dipeptide.
The classic benchmark. Small molecule, but has those key phi and psi backbone angles that define its main shapes. They used a coarse-grained version, no hydrogens, 10 atoms.
How did they partition it?
They set Z to be the backbone atom coordinates, 9 dimensions after fixing rigid motion, and X to be the side group coordinates, 15 dimensions. See figure 7.
And compare against a high-quality reference simulation.
Yes, a long NEA-S simulation. Interestingly, that reference showed both L and D forms because the energy function they used was symmetric.
Did their method find these states?
Figure 8 shows the Ramachandran plots. Remember, their model learns the distribution of Z is backbone coordinates, not FIPC directly. But the plots derived from their model do show density in all the main regions found in the reference, including those corresponding to both L and D forms.
Without being told where to look.
Exactly. No prior info on mode locations. There are some minor differences in the exact shapes compared to their reference, but it finds all the important basins.
And they used a simpler flow model for this.
Significantly fewer parameters than other flow models applied to alanine dipeptide, yes. The CG decomposition helps.
Did they check other properties besides the angles?
They did. Figure 9 compares histograms of the radius of gyration, RG, overall size, and RMSD, shape difference from a reference. The agreement with a reference simulation is very good, especially for RMSD.
So it's capturing not just the main states, but also the overall structural characteristics pretty well?
It seems so, yes. It's quite compelling evidence for the method's potential.
Okay, let's wrap this up. What are the main takeaways from this deep dive into data-free core screening?
Well, the biggest thing is this novel generative framework that learns the Boltzmann distribution using only the interatomic potential. No big simulation data sets needed up front.
Addressing those key limitations of traditional bottom-up CG.
Right. It offers thermodynamic consistency, it neatly solves the back-mapping problem via the bijective transformation, and it demonstrates the ability to capture multiple molecular states without prior data.
And that tempering scheme sounds absolutely essential.
Absolutely crucial for overcoming the mode-seeking nature of the reverse KL divergence training objective, especially in complex systems.
Are there limitations or areas for future work?
Sure. They acknowledge the minor shape discrepancies in the alien dipeptide results, suggesting room for more sophisticated models, maybe incorporating physical symmetries better.
Like using equivariant neural networks.
Potentially, yes. They also mention the computational cost of tempering, although it's likely still cheaper than the massive MD runs it replaces. Improving tempering efficiency is an avenue.
And the most exciting future direction they mentioned.
For me, it's learning the bijective map itself. Right now, the partitioning into Z and X often relies on some chemical intuition. If the model could learn the optimal split automatically.
Automatically discover the best coarse grain variables.
Exactly. That would be huge. It could find important slow coordinates we didn't even know about and potentially lead to even better, more automated back mapping.
That really does sound like a potential game changer. Moving towards fully automated discovery of simplified yet accurate molecular models.
That's the dream, I think. Opening up studies of systems where we don't have good intuition about the slow variables yet.
This has been incredibly insightful. A really clever approach that tackles some long-standing problems in molecular simulation.
It's definitely a very interesting development. By shifting focus from data-driven fitting to directly learning from the energy landscape via this structured decomposition, it really could push the boundaries of what we can simulate.
Okay, so on that note, we'll leave you, the listener, with this thought. Could this kind of data-free approach truly revolutionize how we build and use coarse-grained models? Could it unlock simulations of systems far more complex than we can currently handle, maybe leading to discoveries about molecular behavior we haven't even conceived of yet? Something to think about in your own field? Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.